To be able to answer these questions, like to come up with solutions for cancer, we've asked the basic questions. How does cancer progress? So we basically now know that, look, the initial idea was that these are dividing cells, randomly dividing cells which have lost control. We then knew that these arise from mutations in chromosomal abnormalities. And now we basically know that these are mutations that can happen in repressor genes or in oncogenes. Each of these couldn't actually, has limited contributions to cancer, but when you combine the two, you can actually end up with tumorigenesis. So this is the state of knowledge today. I mean, in the sense that we pretty much know what, or quite a bit know about what causes cancer. Now, if you look at the drug discovery perspective, based on what, how the knowledge of cancer chemotherapy, or cancer progression arose, the first set of ideas were that, where that the cells were dividing rapidly, right? So how do you actually stop the cells from dividing? A lot of innovation actually came from warfare. So most of the drugs or cytotoxics that are used are drugs that were actually kind of discovered for warfare, right? So drugs, for example, doxorubicin or cisplatin, were just alkylating agent which would actually go and bind to the DNA. And this would actually prevent the DNA from replicating, hence you'd actually inhibit the cells from dividing. On the other hand, the next set of drugs were drugs. So this is basically a electron micrograph of two cells or cancer cells dividing, right? So what happens is you can actually see that there's this junction which have these fibers. And if you could actually stabilize these tubules, you can actually prevent the cells from dividing. Very simplistic ideas of how do you prevent a cell from dividing. And that was the tenet for discovery of the first set of drugs, the cytotoxics. So Taxol and Vincristin would actually bind to these tubules, prevent the cells from dividing. Now the problem with this approach is it actually targets any cell that is dividing, and we actually know that that's the reason for a lot of side effects. But so we kind of progress further. Now we know that cancer is more than just dividing cell. So this is a cross-section of a tumor. Here are the tumor cells which are dividing. This is an electron micrograph. You can actually see a lot of huge blood vessel. This is a blood cell. You can actually see a lot of matrix. And the interesting bit is, so I study matrix biology also. We have developed sequencing technologies for studying the sugars that form the matrix. I won't talk about that. That's the fundamental side of what we do. But the fact remains that even the matrix is abnormal in a tumor. And just a snippet, it's actually less sulfated than normal tissue. You actually see this blood vessel. And the idea was that if we actually target beyond this dividing cell, you can inhibit the vasculature, for example. And this is what Folkman suggested way back in 1971, that you could inhibit the vasculature supplying a tumor, and you can starve the tumor to death. And then we kind of moved on towards molecular medicine, which is today. So now we have moved from past to today. And the idea is to kind of target oncogenic mutations. So what we know now is that there are multiple different targets which are mutated or are overexpressed. So EGFR, KIT, MET, VEGFR. VEGFR is the one which is implicated in angiogenesis, as we have heard yesterday. All of them now signal through all these myriad of pathways. We know that like these can also be mutated downstream. And now we have drugs against EGFR, for example, Tarceva or Iressa, which have reached the clinics. MET kinase inhibitors are in the pipeline. VEGFR inhibitors, for example, Avastin is actually widely used. But this is what happens. The fact is that, you know, each dose of Avastin would cost you $7,000. A Tarceva dose would cost you $4,500. Nexavar costs about $4,300 per dose. And the fact is, the 95% of the people in the population in the world can't afford that these drugs. I mean, so I'm from India, having been to a medical school there, I know what the status of the buying power of people there is. So the question is, we are actually kind of producing drugs which are out of reach of most of the people. And the reason that happens is basically captured in these few pictures. Right? So this is basically, assume, so in this case, this is a car which has fallen into the lake. Kind of metaphorically speaking, this is drug discovery program. Okay, this is your target. And drugs, this is the target, this is the drug that you're discovering. It's almost out. And the program, this basically crashes. So what we have been doing is, you bring in a bigger program with the same thought process. And that crashes too. Okay? So what happens today is, if you look at the past, it used to cost us, just about 20 years back, it used to cost about $250 million to develop a drug, 10 years. And in fact, like the number of new chemical entities that were reaching the market were about 40. Look at the increase in efficiency with all the discovery programs and platforms we have today. It cost us $1.5 billion to develop a drug, 15 years to market, 30 drugs instead of 40. Okay, so something is definitely wrong in the procedure. So what we need is a transformation in medicine. And that is actually being heralded by nanotechnology, because you can actually kind of use this thing to kind of optimize costs. And if you think about in terms of its implications in cancer, you can have implications in diagnostics. So you can have very sensitive diagnostic capabilities that I would not talk about today. And you can also impact therapeutics. So what I do is, so today what I do is I'll tell you three stories that we have developed in the last few years about implications of nanotechnology in chemotherapy. But then if you talk about nanotechnology, it's not a new thing. You know, it was 1959 in Chicago. So Feynman basically gave a talk at the American Physical Society meeting on the December 1959. It's surprising that anybody would actually go out of home on 29th of December. But so what he said was that there's nothing in physics that actually prevents you to move things atom by atom or create things atom by atom. So the theoretical principle existed, but it's the fact that it took us about 50 years to reach where we are is because we never had the tools. So now we can actually go and plug and play with what, you know, like at an atomistic level. We can come up with simple chemistry that can take small things and build it up to a nanostructure. So the tools exist today. That's the reason why you're hearing nanotechnology so much. It's not that it's a novel concept. And just to give you a perspective of the size, this is how it is. So the nanoscale is basically between 1 to 100 nanometers. Some people say that it can be actually bigger. Or anything that you can actually build from nanostructures is also under nanotechnology. This is H1N1 virus. This is a macrophage engulfing a cell. So that's in the micron range. And this is the thickness of human hair. So what we're talking about is 1/500th the thickness of your hair. So that's the thing that I would be talking about today. So as I said, I'll tell you three stories. So first one is about drug discovery based on structure-activity relationships and nanotechnology. Okay, so this is a drug which is basically one of the most commonly used drug in chemotherapy. It is probably the top three sellers in the world. Very simple, discovered way back in 1960s. So this is the structure. It is a platinum molecule with two amino groups on one side and two chlorine molecules. So what happens when you inject it into the body is this chlorine group is rapidly dropped off. This is a little bit of chemistry that I'd go into. It's replaced by an OH group. And this binding is very weak. So the moment this structure gets into the cell and it's recognized by the DNA, this drops off and the platinum would intercalate into the DNA. And when that happens, that basically causes excision in the sense that the enzymes will come in and chop off the DNA. So that's how it actually works. So this is called this is a process of activation. The same thing happens in your kidney. So the amount of and it actually goes and binds to your tubule cells in the kidney. And if you exceed about 450 milligrams per kg of cisplatin, the kidney will fail. And so it is dose max. The amount of cisplatin that you can give in a patient is maxed. You cannot exceed that dose. But it is actually the most potent chemotherapeutic agent that you can think of. So to improve cisplatin in the sense that reduce its nephrotoxicity. What people have done is they've replaced this CL group with these moieties. So this is called a dicarboxylato bond, where OO is sequestered by PT. This is held very tightly, so it doesn't come off. It comes off partially in the tumor, but it's actually less nephrotoxic, hardly nephrotoxic in fact. The fact is that these two drugs are actually 1/50th in terms of efficacy of cisplatin. So we have actually increased the side effect profile, you have reduced nephrotoxicity, you have also reduced its efficacy. But again, this drug, for example, is sold by Sanofi Aventis. It's a $3 billion product. Okay, and the only advantage over this is, as you can see, this NH3 has been replaced by this huge moiety, and you can overcome resistance against cisplatin. So that is the advantage of developing this drug. Again, the binding is constant here, as here. So what we decided was, could we come up with a strategy where you can come up with a drug which is as potent as cisplatin, but less nephrotoxic? And that's where nanotechnology came in. So what happens is, our kidney cannot filter anything which is greater than 5 nanometer in size. Okay, so if I can take this structure, I can increase its size to 5 nanometers and beyond, this will not go into the kidney. So that is the goal. So, and we knew that this is a structure which stabilizes the platinum, but this is also less toxic in some terms of efficacy. So again, like, this was the starting point. So what we did was we started looking for polymers that can give us a big size and offers this kind of a binding site, or OH, to the platinum. We found this polymer, it's called polyisobutylene malic acid. It's used in water filtration system. And when you open this up, you get a malic acid, an OH-OH here. I can actually kind of couple platinum to this site. But if I do that, you get a structure exactly like this, except that this is like a polymer, which is N, and N equals to 40. So 40 monomers of this would be sequestered in platinum. The funny thing is, we actually made that, and it was actually less efficacious than cisplatin. Almost 54 less efficacious. It was as ineffective as carboplatin. So the next thing that we did was, we did some smart chemistry. We shifted an electron from here to here. So in this case, we derivatized this with glucosamine. Again, it's a biocompatible molecule. So what happens then is, when I do that, you can actually see that this OH is converted into an O. And when I complex platinum with it, what I get is a coordinate bond. So this is an O, a platinum, and an O coordinate bond, which is an electron which is shared. This is less stable than this bond, but more stable than cisplatin. So when I do that, what we found is the efficacy is actually increased, because the platinum now can come off easier. So what also happened in between was, one experiment didn't work. So one batch that we produced failed. So we went back and changed every parameter that had gone into synthesis. And after 6 months of effort, we figured out that the millicule water system on that day was not working. The water that we had a pH of 8.4 instead of acidic in a DNS condition. And in a pH of greater than 7, we get this structure. So where this thing folds in, and the N basically now complexes with platinum. And you can see that these are single peaks, so these are two isomeric states. When you have this, an NPT bond is very strong as compared to an OPT coordinate bond. This doesn't work. It's this molecule which basically works. And if I show you the pictures of how it looks like, when I have 40 N, this is the structure that you get. So we have taken cisplatin, and the sole molecule is now as big as 100 nanometers. This is a dynamic laser light scatter of these structures. So very tightly dispersed molecules of about 100 nanometer in size. So this doesn't go into the kidney. Again, like, these are efficacy curves. This is carboplatin. This is cisplatin. As you can see, it's most effective. This is when this is basically the cisplatin nanoparticle that we have synthesized. This is so we tested the animals, the drug in an ovarian cancer model where the cancer is generated using RAS-PTEN mutation. So here you can actually see that the tumor without treatment, it grows big. This is cisplatin at 1.25, cisplatin at 3 milligrams per kg. At the same dose, the tumor actually grows. Same dose of nanoparticle, it actually regresses. I won't go into, I don't know if it's very clear, but these are tumor and kidney tunnel staining. You can actually see that cisplatin 3 milligrams per kg of cisplatin of free drug causes significant apoptosis in the kidney, and all the free drugs cause tumor apoptosis. We tested the same thing in a lung cancer model. This is 3 milligrams per kg of cisplatin free drug, which is as efficacious as 3 milligrams per kg of the nanoparticle, right? So here are the growth curves. But at this dose of free drug, this is the drop in body weight, and this is the drop in the kidney weights. So almost like 50% drop in kidney weight. And this is the same dose of the nanocisplatin. So what we have done is we have taken structure activity relationships to design a better cisplatin, which is as efficacious as cisplatin now. I'll shift gears into the next story, which is targeted therapeutic. And again, like the idea is that could this approach or could nanoparticles be adapted for the next generation drugs? So again, like coming back to this picture, we can come up with drugs that inhibit EGFR or MET or VEGFR, but the fact remains that, you know, yes. I'm sorry? Well, these are just, I just kind of picked it from a, there's no distinction. So these basically, you can actually come up with drugs that inhibit each of these, but what happens now in the clinics is that EGFR inhibitors are developing resistance because MET inhibitors, MET kinase goes up, okay? So the strategy is either you come up with a pan-kinase inhibitor, which is what everybody's doing, or you can think about targeting nodes, which are, you know, common downstream of the signals. So if you can inhibit one of these, probably you'll get a better response. So there are drugs in the pipeline which inhibits these nodes. Now, and this is an interesting question for modelers in terms of which node to actually target. So I talk about inhibiting the MAP kinase pathway using nanotechnology. We also did the same thing for AKT or the PI3 kinase pathway. And interestingly, we found that when you inhibit MAP kinase, you actually get inhibition of tumor growth. PI3 kinase failed to do so, even though you get response with PI3 kinase inhibitors in the clinics. Why that is so, we don't know. And these could be interesting questions. But what we found is PI3 kinase inhibitors in a nanoparticle prevents angiogenesis. So it prevented angiogenesis, but the tumor regression was not evident. So this is a lot of chemistry, but you don't have to focus on it. The fact is that, like, so this is the polymer that we use. This is a biodegradable polymer called PLGA, polylactic acid glycolic acid. It degrades in the body. It's approved by FDA, but it's a linear polymer. So we took a drug. This is an experimental study. So we took a drug which inhibits MAP kinase. It's commercially available, called PD-98059. Not very effective. The assumption was that we would reach enough concentration in the tumor using nanotechnology so that it would be efficacious. So if you conjugate this to this linear polymer, it actually is, the loading is so low that you can't ever reach clinical dosages. So these chemistries are effectively processes that we have developed to modify the polymer to increase the loading by about 20-fold, which allows us to go into clinical studies, clinical ranges. And these are the nanoparticles that come out of it. Now, the next thing that we had to do was, so when we injected that, we found that a lot of that nanoparticle is cleared by the immune system. So the next thing was that we had to mask the nanoparticles from the immune part, the reticular endothelial system. So what we did was we took PLG again, derivatized it with polyethylene glycol. So what the idea was that these PEG chains will now stick out because it's hydrophilic, this being hydrophobic, and you get enhanced circulation time. to test this, we conjugated biotin to the PEG and then probed it with streptavidin gold. So you can actually see the nanoparticles here. And when I probe it with streptavidin gold, it's on the surface. So this is a cross-section of a nanoparticle. And this kind of shows that the PEG is actually on the surface. So when we incubated these, the PD9059 nanoparticle with the cell lysate, you can see the drug is rapidly coming out over a period of 120 hours. And it actually causes inhibition of phosphorylation of ERK, which is downstream of MAP kinase signaling. So that was just validation. And this is one of the experiments that we did with a melanoma model, which has activated RAS. So here, in this case, you can see the vehicle size. It's huge. And PD9059 alone, that's the size of the tumor. This is with the nanoparticle. And you see a slightly improved efficacy because, but these are not too significantly different. But the interesting bit was cisplatin was actually very effective. But when you combine cisplatin with the nanoparticle, you see a profound suppression of the tumor growth. Okay, and it's actually far better than cisplatin and PD nanoparticle on its own. I mean, PD9059 on its own. So this improvement, I mean, in fact, 50% of the tumors had complete regression of the tumor. So what we believe is the sustained release actually makes a big difference in terms of combination therapies. And the reason that you get enhanced concentration of the nanoparticles in the tumor is actually captured in these pictures. So this is the vasculature supplying a normal tissue. This is the vasculature in a tumor. So what happens is these tumors have leaky vasculatures, which are as big as 600 nanometers. So these have huge pores in them. If you make the particles stealth, in the sense that they're not cleared by the immune system, it's almost like putting in something into the water system. The only way it can come out is basically through open pipes. So these are open pipes. And what you see is over a period of time, you get almost a two-fold to three-fold increase in tumor concentrations. So quickly kind of show you the next generation in the sense that we've shown that nanoparticles synergize with free drugs. Could we actually put two drugs together in the same nanoparticle and use chemistry to trigger the release? So this is a movie, a cartoon, which captures something that we have done recently too. So this is how a tumor grows. I mean, this is something that you've heard quite a bit. And as it starts growing beyond a certain size, the core basically becomes hypoxic. It starts secreting these growth factors or antigenic factors, which creates a gradient, as you heard yesterday, and then recruits the vasculature. Okay, this is simple angiogenesis, which then would actually cause the tumors to metastasize and grow. So you can actually see, it's a pretty cool animation where you can actually see the tumor cells going into the bloodstream and metastasizing. Now, the thing is that you can come up with an angiogenic therapy because it's a different system from normal vasculature, which would shrink the tumors. But if you think theoretically, if you shrink the tumors, in the sense that if you starve the tumors of oxygen or nutrients, you actually revert it back to the same stage where you started off with, in the sense that, you know, you'd start getting hypoxic cores, enhanced growth factors, and you can get an autocrine loop. And in fact, it has been now shown that MET receptors go up and it can actually survive. So you need to give chemotherapy agents, but there is no vasculature to supply the chemotherapeutic agents over a few cycles. So this is something that we have designed, and I'll show you some of the pictures later. This is a nanoparticle, about 200 nanometers in size. It has two layers. So there's an outer layer and an inner nanoparticle. So it's pretty much a balloon and small balloons inside. So the outer layer has an anti-angiogenic agent. The inner layer has an anti-cancer agent conjugated to the polymer. So what happens is these are masked from the immune system. They circulate in the body, and through these pores would home in into the tumor. Once it homes in, the whole thing is structured in a way that the bigger balloon, the outer balloon, bursts. So the moment it bursts, it would release anti-angiogenic agents, because that's packed in the outer layer, would cause the vasculature to regress. So this problem, so what happens next is As the vasculature regresses, the tumor becomes hypoxic. It starts secreting esterases, or carboxyesterases to be precise. And then these esterases would actually go and bind to the inner polymer, the smaller nanoparticles inside. And this triggers the release of the next drug. So, and which is basically a cytotoxic agent. So you can actually use smart chemistry to stage release of two drugs using nanotechnology, which is otherwise would have been excluded from the tumor. So the idea is that these nanoparticles would now sequentially release the chemotherapeutic agent and cause the tumor to regress. So this is what the chemistry that went into it. So this is the polymer. This is doxorubicin, the cytotoxic agent. We can actually make small nanoparticles out of it. We can coat these nanoparticles with a lipid layer, so you can actually see the outer layer. And you can put an antiangiogenic agent. This is comradistatin in this outer layer. And this is how it looks like in terms of efficacy. So these are different controls that we have used. So when you basically have this stage release, which we call it a nanocell, you can see that the tumor has regressed as compared to both the drugs being released together. So these are the tumor graphs. And these are the drugs alone. So this allows us to basically plug and play with different combinations. And so we have actually started a company around it. And recently, Taiba Hassan's group at the MGH has now used Avastin and gemcitabine in this same formulation. And they have shown that it actually has the same efficacy, but in a pancreatic cancer model. So they're there. Yes? Oh, this one? This is so this purple is basically nanocell, and LC, this is a lower dose, half the dose of this. Yeah, so there's a dose response effect. So this is the second question that I would like to pose to like the modelers here, or the mathematicians here. We've shown that like two drugs can be combined, but we have seen that it's not that trivial. So if you basically switch the release kinetics, you basically lose efficacy. So this is an example of that experiment. So in the sense that, here is a tumor which basically didn't receive anything. Vatalanib is basically a drug that inhibits VGFR. So if I give VGFR prior to giving the nanoparticle, here is the effect. But if I give the dose, the Vatalanib on the same day of giving the nanoparticle, you actually see the effect is actually less. So how do you figure out the sequence? Because this is critical in defining the nanoparticles, in designing the nanoparticles. And if we can figure out what are the most optimal combinations or rational based on what exists in the literature, that can actually define optimizing chemotherapies with nanotechnology. The second problem that is facing this community is the shapes of nanoparticles. Nanoparticles can be of different shapes. So in this case, here is a fullerol, which is round in shape, and a carbon nanotube. Chemistry-wise, they're identical. This is something that we've recently done. It was published in ACS Nano. Absolutely same chemistry, just the shape is different. Here you can see that it's linear shape. And if I basically dose a zebrafish, for example, this is a very nice model to study angiogenesis. If I use this was, both of them were carrying doxorubicin, which is extremely toxic. So if I dose this, you can see that the vasculature is completely gone. If I give this, it actually promotes vasculature despite carrying a chemotherapeutic agent. Why? We don't know. It seems that these structures actually sequester integrins, but it's too early to kind of comment. So these are perplexing questions that exist in the community and would be very useful to understand. So what we know is that cancer is still an uphill battle, but this is a battle which is basically won by survivors who have refused to give up. And these are thousands in numbers, millions in numbers. And so our research is not basically just to publish a paper or tinker around with something, but we believe that innovation empowers these people. And that's the motivation for doing drug discovery or in the chemotherapy space. So people who have contributed to the work that I've shown today, Rania and Shilipto basically did the MAP kinase inhibition pathway. Abhimanyu is a superb chemist. He's looking for faculty positions. He actually designed the cisplatin nanoparticle work. Shivani has just joined as an assistant professor at the University of Alabama. Padmapurna did the structure, the size, the shape effects of nanoparticles. And Dirk is a faculty member now in Harvard Medical School. Funding from these organizations, which have been extremely creative in terms of, giving a free hand in terms of innovation. So I'll take questions.